From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet Bob Kane, the artist who brought Batman to life and drew him for a quarter century. Also today, we meet rocker Ben Vaughn, the man who has everything, including the wrong haircut. Rock historian Ed Ward looks back at the early days of Ray Charles, and linguist Jeffrey Nunberg has some thoughts on snobbery, class, and enunciation. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. On day three of the extraordinary Congress of the Soviet Union's Communist Party, the government's chief economic expert warned the party would suffer defeat if it opposes the switch to a market economy. NPR's Ann Garrels is in Moscow.
Leonida Balkin warned the delegates attending the party Congress against accepting dogmas and myths. Myth number one, he said, is that you can achieve prosperity without sacrifice. Myth number two, he continued, is that you can make the transfer without changing prices. The largely conservative Congress interrupted a Balkin speech with derisive applause. One after another, delegates took the podium today to charge the Communist Party has done nothing concrete to solve the country's problems. The main target of these charges was ideology chief Vadim Medvedev. While it's generally agreed the party lacks a clear vision, one delegate noted this is because the members have such contradictory points of view. This delegate said for the party to talk of consolidation is absurd. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
The last of the Soviet economic sanctions against Lithuania was lifted today as the Kremlin allowed rail shipments of key foodstuffs. Lithuanian officials say the shipments should resume within 2 or 3 days, depending on the availability of rail cars. Oil shipments started up again on Saturday, and the flow of natural gas was brought back up to normal yesterday. Moscow agreed to end the embargo after the Lithuanian parliament voted to freeze its independence declaration for 100 days during negotiations on secession. President Bush is off to London this evening for a meeting with other NATO leaders. The president closed out his vacation in Maine by praising remarks from a top Soviet official that the Soviet Union should cut back its defense spending. Alan Dowd of Maine Public Broadcasting reports.
President Bush told reporters that Soviet Foreign Minister Edvard Shevardnadze made a good observation when he told the Communist Party Congress that continued high Soviet defense spending could ruin the country.
I think the point is, the world is changing now. I hope they'll feel they don't need the defense, and that'll mean that they'll free up funds to do more at home, and it'll also free up Westerners' willingness to try to assist on the economic front.
The president has been opposing Western economic aid to the Soviets, saying that they must make economic reforms first. That opposition sets the stage for a conflict in London with NATO partners France and Germany. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Dowd in Kennebunkport.
West Germany clinched its place in the World Cup soccer finals today by defeating England on penalty kicks after a tie game. The penalties brought the score to 4-3 after tying at 1-1 in overtime. West Germany will now have a chance to avenge its 3-2 defeat by Argentina in the 1986 World Cup. Argentina beat the World Cup host country, Italy, yesterday by the same score, 4-3 on penalty kicks. This is NPR. Liberian President Samuel Doe met today with the U.S. ambassador to discuss an American offer to help him leave the country in the face of a rebel takeover. Reporters on the scene in Monrovia, the Liberian capital, said that Ambassador Peter DeVos drove under heavy U.S. Marine Guard to Doe's fortified presidential palace for about an hour of talks. An unconfirmed report said that Doe has declined the U.S. escape offer. Telex and telephone lines from Monrovia were not working, and no further information on the report was available. Former Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin says that Israel's failure to move toward peace with the Palestinians could lead to a coalition of war against Israel. Linda Gradstein reports.
Speaking at a press conference in Tel Aviv, Rabin said that Iraq has emerged as the strongest Arab country and the most serious threat to Israel. He said there is a direct connection between the peace process and Israel's relations with the Arab world. If the peace process remains frozen, there will be more political cooperation between Iraq and other Arab countries such as Jordan that could eventually lead to a joint military front. Rabin said that Israel has the capability to deter a war with Iraq alone, but if Iraq and Jordan or Syria join forces, it could pose a threat. Rabin said Israel should begin talks with a Palestinian delegation in Cairo immediately. He is also fighting a bitter campaign to unseat labor leader Shimon Peres and push for early elections against Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir's right-wing Likud party. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Officials for the World Bank say the international lender made far fewer loans to developing nations during the past fiscal year. The World Bank and its affiliate, the International Development Association, approved a total of $20.7 billion in loans, $600 million less than in the prior year. A World Bank report says a reduction in lending to China accounts for most of the difference. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Batman, Robin.
That's right. We're after some jewel thieves, but our car's been disabled. May we use yours?
Sure, hop in.
No, I meant we'll take yours, and you stay here with ours. There might be trouble.
Well, trouble don't bother me none. But if that's the way you feel about it, take her and welcome.
Pretty wooden for superheroes, huh? Apparently, one of Batman's special gifts is the ability to survive even the clunkiest portrayal, like that 1949 movie serial. Batman triumphed last summer in the movie that became the highest-grossing film of all time. My guest, Bob Kane, is the creator of Batman. Over the years, he's watched the Cape Crusaders' continuing adventures with alternate pride and horror. Kane created Batman in 1939 and continued drawing him for DC Comics until 1966, the year the Batman TV series debuted. When he gave up drawing Batman comics, Kane started painting Batman on canvas. He's also written several TV screenplays and created a few new characters. Kane has written a new autobiography. It's called Batman and Me. Kane created Batman a year after the debut of Superman comics. The idea of creating a new superhero was initiated by Kane's editor at DC Comics.
Well, I was having lunch with the editor that time, Vincent Sullivan, and he said he was looking for another superhero. Actually, Superman was created in 1938, and the period when I spoke to Vincent Sullivan, it was 1939, it was about a year later. And prior to that, I was doing fill-in cartoons for DC Comics and making maybe $20, $25 a week. And I asked Vincent Sullivan how much money the Superman artists were making, Siegel and Shuster. He said they were making $800 a week apiece. Now, in 1938, that was comparable to about $5,000 a week today. And I was kind of a poor kid from the Bronx looking to, you know, get wealthy and famous. So I said, hey, for that kind of money, I could create a superhero. So I went home that weekend, and I drew upon some of my early influences. And as I recalled, I was 18 at the time, but when I was 13 years old, I saw a book by Leonardo da Vinci, a book of inventions. And he had one book with a flying machine, an ornithopter, and it was a man on a sled with huge bat wings. And even Leonardo had a quote on that particular invention. It was the first man in flight, the first glider, actually. And the quote was, your bird shall have no other model but that of a bat. And it kind of initiated an idea to me about a Batman. And that was when I was 13 years old. So that weekend, I drew upon that influence, and there were movies I used to be influenced by as a kid, one called The Mark of Zorro, The Dual Identity with Douglas Fairbanks Sr. And that gave me my second influence. During the day, he was a board count in the Southern California in the 1880s. And at night, he became a crusader fighting against the injustices of the dictatorship at that time. And so that was my second influence for The Dual Identity. And then there was a movie called The Bat. And the bat was a villain, but he wore a bat costume, and I guess that influenced me for a bat costume also. So they were my three major influences.
Why did you make Batman someone without superpowers? I mean, he was a regular mortal who was very, very fit and very clever, but he didn't really have superpowers like Superman did.
Exactly. For one thing, I didn't want to emulate Superman and imitate it because I thought maybe they wouldn't want that. And I wanted to come up with something original, for one thing. And secondly, I felt that every person that doesn't have superpowers could relate to Batman a lot easier than they could to Superman. In other words, you didn't have to come from another planet to be a superhero. All you had to do was be born rich and build your body into perfection and have the urge to go out and fight crime. So most people like the idea that Batman never had superpowers. They can relate to him a lot quicker than to a superhero with superpowers.
Now, you said that his look, Batman's look, was inspired in part by the Zorro movie that you liked so much. Now, you were, when you were young, in a gang called the Crusading Zorros, and you used to wear hooded masks. What was the connection between the Crusading Zorros that you were a member of as a kid in the Bronx and the Batman look?
Well, to begin with, we wore Zorro wore a mask at night to hide his identity, so that the desperados that he would apprehend would know him during the day if they saw him. Therefore, they couldn't retaliate. And when I was a kid and living in the Bronx, we had these clubs, that we would all band together to protect ourselves against rival gangs in other neighborhoods. It was pretty tough in the Bronx at that time. And so we wore Zorro masks to hide our identities when we would raid one of the rivals' clubs and kind of beat up on them. And therefore, if they wanted to retaliate, Terry, they wouldn't know who to apprehend because we wore the masks of Zorro. It was a dual identity, so to speak.
You tell a terrific story in your book, Batman and Me, about how when you were young and in this gang, the Crusading Zorros, that you know, you weren't wearing your costume this day, and you were being pursued by a rival gang called the Vultures.
Yeah.
And at one point, before they really beat the heck out of you, at one point you thought that you had overcome them. What was the feeling like then? And I'm wondering if you felt like a superhero for that brief moment when you thought you had outwitted them.
Yeah, well, you see, we were very impressionable, and I was particularly because of my creative mind. And I always related to my influences. Like when I saw James Cagney in The Public Enemy, I thought I was James Cagney. And a famous scene in The Public Enemy occurred when James Cagney thrust a grapefruit into his girlfriend's face because she annoyed him. So I tried out on one of my girlfriends when I was very young. And I pushed a grapefruit in her face one night, and she quickly retaliated by hitting me over the head with a chair, and that cured my penchant for grapefruits and hitting girls in the face with a grapefruit. But at any rate, getting back to your earlier question, which eludes me at the moment, what was that again?
Oh, about if when you had briefly eluded the Vultures, if you felt like a superhero.
Exactly. So when I was caught by this vulture gang, I was heading toward my neighborhood, and we had a lumber yard that we used to play out in with a lot of nooks and crannies, and I knew it very well. And somehow that early evening, none of my gang members were around and to join me in the fight. And so I jumped over the fence and kind of hid in some of the nooks and crannies until they caught up with me. But then I remembered Zorro's daring do deeds of jumping around when he fought the desperados in the Spanish West. And so I started to climb shafts of lumber. And when I arrived on the highest part of the lumber yard, the highest shafts, I felt like I was King Kong atop the Empire State Building. And I started thrusting these shafts of lumber down on the vultures who were below in the lumber yard. And then I started swinging around on the pulleys, and I really felt for a moment victorious because I had the advantage for quite a while because I knew the lumber yard and they didn't. But then I fell off one of the shafts of lumber, cascaded down around me when I landed on it, and I fell to the ground. And that's when they all attacked me. There were about six of them, and they really beat up on me pretty badly. They broke my arm and a couple of my front teeth. And then they crushed my knuckles, my right hand, the drawing hand. And actually, this injury inadvertently kept me out of the service in World War II, although I enlisted in the Navy after Pearl Harbor. But I have kind of partial use of my drawing hand, and I have two porcelain jackets that remind me of that I'm going to stay in the lumberyard when I was a young and reckless boy growing up in the Bronx.
Now,
I really lived a real-life adventure, sort of like the ones I draw today in Batman.
Bob Kane is my guest, and he's written an autobiography called Batman and Me, which includes a lot of excerpts from Batman comics over the years. He originated the comic in 1939. Now, here you were, a Jewish kid growing up in the Bronx, right? Your superhero is named Bruce Wayne. I mean, what a very not-Jewish name.
Well, it's an alliteration of Bob Kane.
Oh, okay.
Bruce Wayne.
Well,
alliteration. I wanted it to sound... I wanted to be Bruce Wayne in my reverie and in my daydreams. I felt, instead of a poor kid, I imagined I'd like to be a rich playboy and fight crime at night, because I hate all injustices in the world.
Would it have been possible to have made a Jewish superhero, or was that out of the question at the time?
Well, only for the Jewish Forward, which is a newspaper in the Bronx. But that's the only paper that would take a Jewish hero.
Tell me why you decided to draw Batman in tights and shorts. Now, I know Superman was drawn that way.
Well, actually, it's called the Union Suit character. And for whatever reason, Superman started it, and it seemed to work. And mine was second, except I used a bat cape and the bat symbols, the bat mystique, which spread out into the bat cave, the batmobile, the Batarang, and so forth. I used the entire Bat mystique to create my Bat world. Superman only had a telephone booth. So mine is really more merchandisable, so to speak, and also more misterioso. Yeah. Somehow you enhance an idea. You begin with it. It's just a germ of an idea. And as I studied the history of comics in America, all the comics heroes were very crude at the beginning, and they developed along the way. Like Dick Tracy didn't have a two-way wristwatch when he started. That came along later.
You started off doing slapstick comics and then turned to Batman. How did your drawing style change to create the Batman mood?
Well, I was a very good copyist, Terry, and I was able to copy superheroes at an early age. At 15, I could copy Flash Gordon almost as well as the artist who drew him, Alex Raymond. And I used to dabble in copying all the comics, slapstick as well as the illustrative kind. And the reason for my adaptation and switching over to the illustrative art rather than slapstick art was simply because there was more money in the superhero. Like when I asked Vincent Sullivan how much money the Superman artists were making, they were making $1,600 between them during any given week, and I was making $25. So I did that because of the money, basically. Intrinsically, I really would rather draw slapstick comics. I've always been a great lover of the early Mutt and Jeff and Popeye and Maggie and Chigs, and those were the comics that I grew up on that I wanted to emulate and become a slapstick comic artist. But I realized that the illustrative superhero was probably my forte for making money and fame.
Batman was obviously inspired by the success of Superman. What was the reaction initially of the Superman artists to Batman? Did they think that you were just stealing from them?
No, not really, because Batman really was nothing like Superman in costume or in the general genre. Superman came from a Krypton, another planet, and he had superpowers. He could fly and leap great heights over buildings, where Batman was merely a mortal that wore a bat costume. And no, they weren't surprised, because they knew that there would be a whole slew of imitative superheroes to come, and mine was second. And frankly, Terry, after Batman and Superman, there really wasn't another original superhero in the last 50 years. All they are offshoots, in one way or another, of new costumes based on Superman and Batman. A few of them don't have superpowers like Bruce Wayne, Batman. Most of them do have superpowers, but nobody other than Spider-Man, which came along about 25 years later. And it's kind of a unique character, and it looks like a spider. It's amazing, though, how all the characters other than Superman took on the names of insects, animals, and so forth, if you want to analyze it.
Did you ever see a bat when you were growing up?
Well, I had great fears of bats, and therein lies an amazing dichotomy also. The fact that who thought any character with a name like a Batman would go, only because even my publisher at that time thought it was a very ominous name, and he suggested I change it. And I said, well, why don't we try one issue and we'll see how it goes. But when the issue sold out and I came to him and I said, well, what about changing the name? Let's call him Irving Schwartz the Tailor or whatever. He laughed and he said, no, let's keep the name because, you know, obviously the bottom line in any industry in motion pictures and comic books is money. If you're making money, you stay with it.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about Batman. And my guest is Bob Kane, who created Batman Comics in 1939, and he continued drawing Batman for DC Comics until 1966. He's written a new autobiography called Batman and Me. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Bob Kane is my guest, the creator of Batman. You drew Batman for DC Comics. You stayed with that house. What are some of the pros and cons of doing a comic for a comic book house like that? Who owns the rights to the characters, for instance?
Unfortunately, that's that's part of the negative part of the business, is that when you're young, you sell away your copyrights. And actually, that happens with most of the cartoonists and they owned the character at that time, and I couldn't take it elsewhere. And actually, I was making very good money, and in 1940, 41, I was making practically $1,000 a week. And so you're not about to leave, and $1,000 a week in 1940 was comparable to about $5,000-$6,000 today a week. And so being that they owned the copyright, I did the best I could at the time by compromising and getting a good piece of the action and a perpetuity contract. So therefore, I did rather well compared to some artists who sold it away and didn't get very much out of it.
Have you owned a piece of the merchandising over the years?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm.
Let me,
I do rather well.
I'll bet, yeah.
I mean, all things being equal, I'd love to own it, and I would have done 1,000% better, but I didn't do badly the way it turned out, and life is a compromise. If it weren't for the publisher, I never would have been where I am today. So, you know, one hand washes the other.
How did the comic book code affect you in 1954? And the code restricted content matter of the comics. And this was a period
See, for a while, what happened was, whenever there's a successful industry, you generally have some sleazy fly-by-nights that want to cash in on it and on the coattails of anything famous. And so a bunch of these fly-by-night publishers came out with some really schlocky, if I could use that word, books that depicted sex that we never had, blatant sex, you might say, violence, cutting heads off with the blood oozing out, and they had bad grammar and illicit wordage and so forth. And so a lot of the whole industry suffered along the way with the sleazy books, because a lot of mothers stopped their children from reading comic books in general, including the DC line and other books of our good caliber. So what happened is a code was set up. Like in the early days of the motion picture industry, they had the Hays office, which was a code of ethics of what you could do or what you could show or not show on the screen. If there was too much sex and violence, they cut down on that. I think a censorship is good to a degree, but if you have too much censorship, you take away the freedom of the press and the writer and the artist and so forth.
Were your freedoms restricted? Were there things that you wanted to do and couldn't do when the code was put into practice?
Oh, no. No, our books were never... We censored our own books, so we weren't under the fire of the anti-comic book people and the parents' associations and so forth. No, our books were always clean, so we had nothing to worry about. We just had to sit tight, and then we had a code which the good comic book publishers created, and which had to have every drawing had to have a stamp of approval by the Comics Code of America, and then this knocked out the sleazy comic books only because they couldn't get the code of approval, therefore they couldn't get any distribution, so they stopped publishing, and they only interfered maybe a year or two, and then they all died out, and we went on our merry way publishing clean comic books as they are and have been all through the years.
There are still Batman comics now, yes?
Oh, sure. I mean, we have Ghost Artists. In fact, the new breed of Batman comics are graphic novels, and they're done with hardcovers. Some of them are $30 a book. Some are $25 a book, and they're done on beautiful paper. There's been a whole evolution since the days I created Batman for 10 cents a comic book. Now, Batman number one that I don't own, the 1939 book, the May issue of Detective Comics, has started in 6 pages, now sells for $50,000. There are only about 12 in the country, and I don't have one of them. I had them 1 to 100, but my first wife threw them all out when I got divorced. Hmm. But anyway, one day I'll get number one back, I guess.
Just briefly, can you tell us what you thought of the movie Batman? You were a consultant to that.
Yes, I was project consultant, and I did add a lot of my input. I drew the costumes. I said the costume has to be rigged with wire that when he jumps through a skylight, it'll billow out behind him like a bat. And I critiqued the script and so forth. I thought it was very true to the roots of Batman, the way I started it, whence it came. In other words, Batman had gone back to the Mysterioso, dark, brooding Batman that I created in the early years. I love the campy version, but I really prefer the dark, brooding version. And I think the sets were marvelous. The whole mood of the movie had a different film noir look. And look, it grossed over $250 million. It's one of the all-time top grosses in Hollywood from the time of its inception. And in Europe, it'll probably make another $200 million. And plus the merchandising and the video cassettes, the Batman could very well go to $1 billion. That's more than any movie ever earned or ever will earn in the history of movies. And I love the movie. I thought it just was true to my original dark brooding. I was just worried it shouldn't turn into a campy TV show again, and it did not. It followed faithfully my early... mood of the genre of Batman.
Well, Bob Kane, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. I really enjoyed it. God bless, and we'll see you in the movies of Batman 2.
All right.
Okay.
Bob Kane is the creator of Batman, and he's written a new autobiography called Batman and Me. It's published by Eclipse Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ben Vaughan's record collection spans the history of rock and roll. So does his music. Coming up, getting back to the roots with rocker Ben Vaughan. Also, rock historian Ed Ward plays some of Ray Charles's first recordings before he sounded like Ray Charles. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg thinks about snobbery and enunciation. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Boston, a Christian Science couple has been convicted of involuntary manslaughter for relying on prayer and not conventional medical treatment for an illness that killed their young son. The jury of 8 women and 4 men concluded that the David Twitchells committed wanton negligence in allowing their 2.5-year-old son, Robin, to die of a bowel obstruction in April of 1986. He was ill for 5 days. The Twitchells each face up to 20 years in prison. An attorney says they will appeal. The deputy president of the African National Congress, Nelson Mandela, met with British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher for more than 3 hours today in London. Mandela said the prime minister was generous and called their meeting productive. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports.
Given the division between the British Prime Minister and Nelson Mandela on sanctions and the use of armed struggle by the African National Congress, this meeting was viewed by observers with skepticism. But Nelson Mandela described it as a cordial and friendly one and said that while Mrs. Thatcher's support for ending sanctions in South Africa is well known, he's convinced she's an enemy of apartheid, who differed with him on points. Yet he was convinced together they could make progress in South Africa. While they'd had their quarrels, Mandela said, there was never any personal enmity between them. And he made it clear that while he was not renouncing any of his positions, their meeting had been a personal and diplomatic success. I'm Jackie Lydon in London.
In Iran, President Rafsanjani says that the death toll from a massive earthquake is under 34,000, less than feared at first. He also hinted that foreign earthquake aid that is poured in could pave the way for ending Iran's isolation. Mike Theodula reports.
After touring the disaster zone, Rafsanjani said it appeared earlier casualty figures were exaggerated. Some reports said as many as 50,000 had died. Rafsanjani said there was a huge task ahead to replace more than 100,000 homes, and Iran needed and welcomed building materials from abroad. As long as the giver attached no strings, he said, Iran's policies would naturally be affected by the aid. It was seen as an indication that Tehran is willing to end old enmities. It's known that Rafsanjani has long been keen to mend ties with the West for economic reasons, but is being opposed by hardliners. Observers say the quake has given him the chance to prove to Iranians the value of good international relations. In turn, this could benefit countries like the US and Britain, which have hostages held in Lebanon by pro-Iranian groups. Both helped Iran in its hour of need. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
In daytime robberies, thieves in Paris have stolen 2 paintings after cutting them from their frames. One stolen artwork is a Renoir, which was taken from the Louvre. In New York City, the stock market is closed today because of the holiday, but in Tokyo, stocks closed higher as the dollar fell against the Japanese yen. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. In music, as in most areas of our culture, success breeds imitation. In the post-war era, many young black singers tried to emulate the success of black vocalists like Nat King Cole and Louis Jordan. For the most part, the results sounded pretty generic. But rock and roll historian Ed Ward says one record producer spotted a great talent among the imitators.
In 1935, a terrible 1-2 punch of tragedy hit Aretha Robinson, a young black woman who lived in Greensville, Florida. She had 2 sons, Ray, who was 5, and George, a year younger, and her husband was an itinerant railroad worker, so she had to raise them by herself. Fortunately, both kids were extraordinarily smart, especially George, who was a self-taught mathematical whiz. But one afternoon, George decided to go for a swim in a tub Aretha kept for rinsing the laundry she took in, and although he'd swum in it many times before, this time he drowned. Before the small family could recover from the shock, Ray discovered that a thick substance was coating his eyes, and a local doctor confirmed their worst fears. He was going blind. 2 years later, he was blind. He would have to attend a school for blind black children, and Aretha knew what that meant. He would be taught to beg or to make brooms. But Ray had an ace in the hole. He'd started playing the piano at the corner store. Before he left for school, she counseled him to stay away from the guitar they might try to teach him and concentrate on the piano. He followed her advice, and it's a good thing he did.
A sentimental blues will worry you and make you do things that you wouldn't do. Only when you hear these blues. A sentimental blues.
He was an excellent piano player, and his singing voice wasn't bad either. A young record distributor, Henry Stone, heard him singing in a nightclub one evening and brought him to the attention of a man named Jack Lauderdale, who owned Swing Time, a record label that specialized in sophisticated blues singers. Lauderdale liked what he heard and took Ray and his band, the Maxim Trio, into the studio to cut a bunch of records, including this one. Songs like Rockin' Chair Blues were all very nice, and in the backwoods honky-tonks that the Maxim Trio played, they must have been the height of sophistication. But Lauderdale saw right off that there were problems. One was that the band wasn't good enough for the piano player, and the other was that the piano player sounded just like Charles Brown, who, along with Nat King Cole, was the hottest black singer of the day. Oh, and his name, Ray Robinson, was getting him confused with the boxer who was getting so much publicity, Sugar Ray Robinson. His middle name would have to do for a last name, at least on stage, so Lauderdale's new star put out his next batch of records under his new name, Ray Charles.
Now don't put all your dreams in one basket. Don't put all your hope in one heart. For if you discover that she loves another, you'll be licked before you start.
And another thing, the kid thought he was good on these syrupy ballads, but he was sure no Nat Cole. The trouble was, funkier material didn't sell, except in the South, and Swing Time was looking for a national share of the growing black record market. The only people who liked the down-home stuff in the North were jazz buffs, record collectors like the two sons of the Turkish ambassador to the U.S., Ahmet and Neşvi Erdoğan. They had a little record label of their own, Atlantic. Ahmet, in particular, seemed to be everywhere, and he'd heard of Ray Charles.
Down in St. Pete, Florida, how about my baby there? No one's ever loved me like my baby. Any place, anywhere.
Songs like St. Pete, Florida, recorded live at a party, showed that Ray Charles had another voice, one Ahmet was itching to combine with an up-to-date jazz backup. But was Lauderdale going to let loose of his only star? The answer was yes. Lauderdale was almost broke, and he sold Ray's contract for $2,500.
The midnight hour have found me lonely, so unhappy, as I can be.
At first, Ray insisted on singing in his old style, but they kept after him, and early in 1953, they made the breakthrough that launched a poor blind piano player from Florida and America's top rhythm and blues label simultaneously. Both Ray Charles and Atlantic Records had found their direction.
You can talk about the pit, barbecue. The band was jumping, the people too. Mess around, they're doing the mess around. They're doing the mess around. Everybody doing the mess around. Everybody was juiced, you can bet your soul. They did the boogie woogie with a study roll. They mess around. They're doing the mess around.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. You can get a sense of Ben Vaughan's humor from some of his song titles, like I Feel Like Jerry Lewis in France and I'm Sorry, But So Is Brenda Lee. And from his music, you can hear his immersion in the roots of rock and roll. Vaughan is a songwriter, singer, guitarist, and inveterate record collector. He recently spent time in Capitol's record vaults producing a reissue of sessions by rhythm and blues man Johnny Otis. Ben Vaughan grew up in Camden, across the river from Philadelphia. Ben Vaughan's fourth album, Dressed in Black, features guest appearances by John Hiatt and Marshall Crenshaw. Alex Chilton, formerly of the Box Tops, sits in on piano on this track, Hey Romeo.
One, two, one, two, three.
Hey Romeo,
what are you gonna do?
Hey Romeo,
now that she's leaving you.
Hey Romeo,
what are you gonna do?
Never thought she'd leave a man like you.
Hey Romeo,
you better face the facts.
Hey Romeo,
she won't be coming back.
Hey Romeo,
this is the final act. The train she's a riding's heading down the track.
Hey Romeo,
da-da-da-da-da-da.
Hey Romeo,
da-da-da-da-da-da.
Hey Romeo,
da-da-da-da-da-da. Romeo.
A lot of the songs you write are inspired by rock and roll of the 1950s and 1960s. Is it because that was the period you grew up in, or is it something else about the music?
Well, I started listening to AM radio, I guess it was in about 1964 when the Beatles came out. But I quickly caught up with Chuck Berry and Everly Brothers and New Orleans music and R&B and everything that came before, just because I had to know where this came from, where rock and roll started. So I kind of started looking back at a very young age.
Who helped you look back? Did you just go to the record stores and buy things?
No, I had an uncle who was kind of a delinquent. at least my mother told me he was anyway. And he kind of sat around the house and he did odd jobs for cigarette money and everything. And he would just buy rock and roll records and play them for me.
When you're writing a song that's inspired in part by some earlier music, where do you draw the line between stealing a line and paying homage to a favorite record?
What I do is I put the records out, and if anybody wants to sue me, they can contact me. That's how I feel about it. No, I think that I draw on it as reference material, and then I'm writing a song, and I just happen to place it in the style that I like at that time or whatever.
I want to play some of Too Sensitive for This World. Did this start out as a serious song or a satirical song?
It started out as a title that I got, and when I got the title, I thought, wow, that's a great title. You know, I'm going to have to write a song with that. And then I didn't do anything with it for about a year, and then the song itself is serious, but the title is potentially funny. You know, it's like I have a tradition of that. I'm Sorry, But So Is Brenda Lee has the same thing, and there's a few others that are basically disguised It's a very serious song, though.
Every day starts with a broken heart. I must be too sensitive for this world. Well, I know it ain't right to cry every night. I must be
too sensitive for this world.
And the world is such a callous place. It's a wonder, it's a wonder,
it's a wonder
anyone survives.
What came first for you, writing or singing?
Writing. I reluctantly became a singer just to basically pitch my songs to other people. That was the intention all along. You know, I was hoping to get other people to do my songs so I could sit around the house, you know, get a royalty check and, you know, sit on the porch.
No such luck, huh?
Nah. I'm working hard now.
So what do you think of your voice? You were reluctant to sing.
Well, I don't mind it so much. You know, it's kind of in the vein of like Johnny Cash or Neil Diamond or somebody like that where, you know, they don't have great voices, but you know it's them. It's a distinctive style, and it's got my personality stamped all over it. And so it's it represents me and who I am.
Now, I read that you didn't make a living with your music till you were around 27.
Even then, I was still working.
What kind of work did you do up until then?
Well, I got out of high school, and I didn't go to college. I got a job at a knitting mill and did that for a while, and then I worked in a factory on an assembly line. And then I was a landscaper, which is basically a glorified term for mowing lawns. I did that for 3 years. And with no sign or hope of getting out of it either. It wasn't like a summer job for me where, you know, I could see the light at the end of the tunnel. Man, that was my lot in life as far as I knew. So I was writing songs that whole time, not showing them to anyone or not really believing myself that they might be any good. I was just doing it to satisfy myself. And I think that really most of my songs wouldn't be possible if I hadn't lived as a total nobody for as long as I did.
You have this great song on your first album called Wrong Haircut,
mm-hmm.
about someone who keeps getting shut out of things because he's got the wrong haircut. What inspired that song?
The New York club scene. In 83... the Combo did a show at Danceteria, which was it's like Satyricon, you know, all these different levels of strange behavior and a very elitist behavior. And I was wandering around before I went on, and there's an elevator. And so I waited for the elevator because I wanted to go to one of the other floors and see what was going on. And the elevator door opened, and there was a black girl with a blue mohawk running the elevator, and she just looked at me and shook her head no and closed the door and wouldn't even let me on.
Oh, she was one of the guards?
Yeah, she worked there, you know. And it just seemed to me like I got this whole vision of there someday being a haircut police, you know.
When I got to the club, I was ready to rock. But when I opened up the door, the music stopped. Uh-oh, wrong haircut. Well, the music went back on and the people were. Around the room. Well, I sat down next to a girl with way out hair. I started talking about art to prove I ain't no square. When I asked her if she thought Van Gogh was where it's at, she picked up her drink and she threw it in my lap. Uh-oh, wrong haircut.
Do you think that the rock scene has gotten any less elitist in terms of you have to look right and behave right and know the right people to get into the clubs?
Well, I don't know about clubs so much, but, you know, now with videos has basically changed rock and roll. And hair is more important than it ever was now. You know, if you watch MTV, you know, hair is very important. If you don't have the right hair, or worse off, if you have no hair, forget it, you know, unless you shave your head. But, It's a very important thing now, so I think it's pretty much the same.
How would we describe your hair?
Unkempt.
Yeah, right. Guess that'll about sum it up. When you look ahead, what kind of future do you see for yourself as a performer? I mean, I call it cynicism, but I just have a feeling that someone as quirky as you probably wouldn't be, you know, like the kind of big star, maybe not get to like even the major label, and it's possible if you did that they wouldn't pay enough attention to make it really matter. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I look at this all as an experiment that I started when I decided that I really didn't want a day job anymore. I'm already a success. I don't have a day job. I'm still amazed by that. Every morning I wake up and realize I don't have to get in my car and drive to some factory or, you know, office or anything like that. I realize that what I'm doing has saved me, and that I'm already successful enough. And I'm, like I said, it's like an experiment. Like I'll take it as far as I can take it, but I'm really not setting goals for myself that are leaving me frustrated now or could leave me frustrated. I think that would be very stupid.
You know, you've listened to a lot of rhythm and blues and jazz over the years, and in both of those musics, there was a history of people of all ages playing it. You didn't have to worry, like, when you got over 30, when you got over 40, what future would you have in music? Has that given you, do you think, a different perspective on, you know, on your future in music than, say, some people who only know rock and roll and have always thought of this, like, age crisis?
Yeah, I really do think so. I think that I have some records by people like Johnny Hodges and Duke Ellington where their playing got better when they got into their 50s or 60s, you know. And it was just, they kept doing it, and they just kept getting better and better and better. Yeah, I think that it's, I can see myself doing this for a real long time.
Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Sure.
Ben Vaughan's new record, Dressed in Black, is on Enigma Records. This is The Man Who Has Everything.
Every year when you buy your Christmas gifts, there's always one name left on the bottom of your list. Well, you can search and search in every store, but you won't find nothing that I ain't had before. 'Cause I'm the man.
He's the man who has everything.
I'm the man.
He's the man who has everything.
Yes, I am.
This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel. Coming up shortly on All Things Considered from National Public Radio, news from Liberia, where rebel forces are in the capital, Monrovia. We'll also hear about Nelson Mandela's visit to London and a human rights worker who complains that Americans, especially African Americans, are too reluctant to criticize African leaders who violate human rights. And a special report by Sandy Tolan about maquiladora factories. Those are the factories in Mexico, just across the border from the U.S., where American-owned firms make their goods with very low-paid Mexican workers. And news of a Soviet circus stranded in Georgia, but at least celebrating the 4th of July. Those stories coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Your parents may have nagged you to speak correctly. Your teachers may have drilled you on making your O's rounder. But linguist Jeffrey Nunberg says you can relax.
One of the most engaging books about language in the past year was Robert McNeil's Wordstruck. It's a memoir about the beginnings of McNeil's infatuation with the English language when he was growing up in the 30s and 40s on Nova Scotia as the son of shabby, genteel parents with a bookish bent. One poignant recollection involved McNeil's mother's insistence that her children speak with clear diction. He tells it this way. Enunciate your vowels, she was always saying. Enunciate your vowels. In the way her father, Dr. Oxner, the dentist, said, masticate your food, masticate your food. And his wife, Daisy Oxner, would ask dramatically, have you moved your bowels? These admonitions all took on the same moral coloring to me and played like mantras through my early years. Have you moved your bowels, masticate your food, enunciate your vowels. I read this and thought, oh yeah, that's my father to a T. Not that my father had a lot else in common with a Halifax schoolteacher. He was a New York businessman, the son of immigrants. But like McNeil's mother, he clung to diction like a raft that would keep him afloat above the plebeian tide. The only difference was that McNeil was a more dutiful son than I. He wound up with diction crisp as Canadian bacon, whereas I was a rebellious child and became a chronic mumbler, condemned to go through life with, "I beg your pardon," and "How's that again?" trailing in my wake. Not long ago, at the urging of Ed Koch, the New York City schools announced a program aimed at eradicating the slovenly speech habits of the city's pupils. Posters would be hung in the schools identifying 20 common speech demons, as they were called, things like, "I'll meet you at the corner," rather than, "I'll meet you at the corner." Now, given the scope of the problems in the New York City schools, this might strike you as a low-priority concern, all the more since this particular enterprise is sublimely futile. Even so, diction has always been a cardinal virtue in the psyche of the North American middle class. Enunciation may not be next to godliness, but it's close. From dropping syllables, it seems only a short step to bad personal habits, incivility, even doubtful political opinions. Just after the First World War, hundreds of thousands of schoolchildren were made to recite a linguistic pledge of allegiance promulgated by a group called the American Speech Committee. It began, "I love the United States of America, I love my country's flag, I love my country's language. I promise that I will not dishonor my country's speech by leaving off the last syllable of words, that I will say a good American yes and no in place of an Indian grunt, uh-huh, or a foreign ya or yeah or nope, that I will do my best to improve American speech by avoiding loud, rough tones, by enunciating distinctly, and by speaking pleasantly, clearly, and sincerely." To see the irony of all this, you don't even have to change the channel. Just leave the set on PBS after the McNeil-Lehrer report goes off and wait for William F. Buckley's firing line. Buckley's upper-class accent shows nothing but disdain for middle-class fastidiousness about enunciation. It has different names in different cities. In Philadelphia, it's sometimes called the mainline malocclusion. In New York, it's Locust Valley lockjaw. But the basic accent is the same throughout the East, the clenched teeth drawl you can hear from Buckley or George Plimpton, the accent that Jim Backus parodied on Gilligan's Island. When working-class children slur their speech that way, it's taken as a sign of laziness, or worse. But in the mouths of upper-class children, it means something else. It shows that they've learned the important lesson that whatever one does, one mustn't sound as if one were trying too hard.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistants from Lisa McCullough and Dan Buskirk. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, folklorist Alan Lomax talks with us about his life collecting and preserving the music of America. Also, we discuss the latest national and international developments in AIDS research and healthcare with journalist Randy Schultz. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
The following program is being simulcast in stereo over 91FM and WHYY-TV-12. To enjoy this program fully, tune your television to channel 12 and turn down the volume on your TV set. If you have cable TV, consult local listings for the cable TV.